Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com. Thank you and welcome to Juno Afternoon from community-supported KTOO. I'm Boston Christopher. You may also join us via our live stream on KTOO's YouTube and Facebook pages. Today, we have previews of the upcoming Juno Audubon Talk, Fins, Furs, and Feathers of the Amazon and the Galapagos, and of this Friday's Fireside Chat, Our Ancient Past, Submerged Archaeology in Southeast Alaska. But first, we are going to deep dive into acoustic turbulence. It's a bold fusion of music, dance, visual art, and poetry that celebrates the poetic journey of the bumblebee and the soul that it symbolizes. With original music, poetry, and choreography, this performance follows a spirit's transformative path from challenge and uncertainty to truth, peace, and unity with the divine. It will play two shows only on Saturday, February 21st, and Sunday, February 22nd at the Thunder Mountain School Auditorium. Joining me now in the studio is Haley Duran. Gunath Chish Wasiati. Haley, how are you today?
Very good. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And then we also have... Who do we have here, Haley?
We also have Anouk Otzi, and she is here to talk a little bit about herself, but she is our Queen Bumblebee in the production.
The Queen Bumblebee. Well, yeah. Anouk Wasiati, Gunath Chish, for being. How are you today?
Gunath Chish, thank you for having me. I'm great. Thank you.
Yeah, welcome, welcome. All right, so let's take a step back, though. We're going to have some others joining us as well.
Yes.
Todd Hunt will be here and a few others to deep dive a little bit more into this project. But Haley, this is a project that was born out of your brain. So mm-hmm. Tell me about the sort of inciting action, or where did this idea come for you? How did this begin?
Well, let's see. So I joined Orpheus Project as their dance director last year, and the mission that they kind of gave me was to come up with some of my own work. They encouraged me to create for myself, which, you know, I've been choreographing and dancing in Juno since 2012, and I don't think I've ever, like, came up with a full concept on my own for a piece that I'm going to work on. Usually the framework is already there, and I'm hired to, like, choreograph for something else.
Yeah, most people who've gone to performances in Juno will probably have seen Haley Duran's name in a program for all of the organizations. You are sort of one of the go-to movement people in town.
Yeah, I mean, and there's and we'll get to that. There's a wealth of a lot of movers in town, but I've been really fortunate to work with a lot of the production companies in town. I love all the premises, all the projects I've worked on this far. This is just a unique process for me because I came up with the concept. And really that all started, I think, Thanksgiving last year. I was talking to our friend Raylan, who is apiary, and I fell in love with her passion that she had for her bees.
Mm.
And she was telling me all about what it was like to have bees and take care of bees. And I thought, I just knew right then. I was like, that's what the next thing is going to be about. I just didn't know what specifically. And then as I kind of started noodling on it and doing research, I, you know, discovered more and more about just our native species, the bumblebee, and fell deeply in love with that animal. And then even though I was like researching what the bumblebee is, who the bumblebee is, what they do for us, I was still looking for something that really tied it for me emotionally, what what inspired me to actually move about the bumblebee physically. And I found that finally when I was researching ancient Egyptian mythology, and they believed that bees represented the journey of the soul. And that really spoke to me. You know, this last year, my grandmother is in her last chapter of life. We're helping her die gracefully. And to me, that just that premise really spoke to me, because I was like, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to use my grandmother as kind of my muse. She is my queen bumblebee. I'll look at her full life in a reflection now that we're at the final chapter of her life. And then it gave me somewhere to put all of that reflection about her, especially as I'm reflecting on the journey of the soul. So I'm using the six stages of the queen bumblebee life cycle, but it really was a way for me to really reflect about the journey of someone's soul and our last and final chapter of our lives.
That's amazing. Now this, I mentioned in the intro that it's got some music, it's got some poetry, choreography. Mm-hmm. So when you begin with something like this as a concept, I love that you got inspired by a friend and then that sort of led you down this path and that sort of initial impulse. How do you then structure that? Did you structure it in a way? Did you write some things down as like, this is what I envision? And then you started working with all the collaborators? Or how did that process for you work solo into collaboration?
Yeah, I wrote... I basically wrote just a really detailed narrative of what I was thinking. It follows the six stages, so at least I had the framework just from nature that I was going to follow. But then as I did my research, I wove in all sorts of different theologies and mythologies that have referenced the bumblebee. I kind of used, you know, those are there for us, for our assistance in reflection. And so... it was really helpful. You know, there's a pas de deux when the queen bumblebee is mating with her drone. And a pas de deux is like a duet between two partners in dance. And so our queen bumblebee dances with the drone in mating. And that entire sequence was inspired by Kamadeva from Hinduism. And it's the journey of the potency of love. And there's like five arrows. He's kind of like the Cupid in that theology, and it goes through all these different feelings and ways to reflect on love, and then ultimately the sting of love. It hurts to love something because it is inevitable that you lose the thing that you love so much. And so all of that was really inspiring, and it just deepens the reflection. And so I just put down into words through each of those six cycles, anything I was using to like fuel my own inspiration and my own stimulus to get myself to move and to think about movement. And I just made sure that I really, really articulated that in the document. And then once I kind of had the full scope of all those six, all my reflections of the full six stages, then I distributed that to the composers, the three composers. And I distributed that to the poet. And then they took that work and composed and wrote based off of that narrative.
I see. Remind me what the six stages are.
So we have a little bit of a prologue. So it's kind of the big beginning, what's in the beginning. And from there, it goes into the bee kind of in the larva state, growing, hatching, eating their way out of their little wax pot that they're birthed into. And then from there, they go into mating is actually the first thing that the queen bumblebee does. So there's the mating phase. And then after she mates, she goes into her solitary phase and diapause. She gets ready. She eats a bunch. And then she goes into hibernation. And then once she is done hibernating, she emerges into another solitary phase and forages, collects things, gets herself ready to birth her worker bumblebees. She builds all her little wax pots, and then she enters what's called the eusocial phase, where she has all these little worker bees that then hatch out. Everyone's working, foraging, pollinating. And then after that phase, she then goes into the gene phase where she births her next generation of queens.
Mm.
And then she dies.
Mm. Mm, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
And so the movement part of it, and joining us now, W. Todd Hunt, Gunath Chishwa, CET Todd, how are you?
Yeah, great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So we are talking about Acoustic Turbulence, which is going to be Orpheus Project's next performance. It's on February 21st. That's a Saturday, and then Sunday, February 22nd, you can go to orpheusproject.org for more information and get all the details and all the long list of names. There's a lot of people involved in this. Haley sort of is the creator, originator of the idea, and then collaborated with all these fine folks, one of them being Anouk, who is playing the Queen Bee.
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about your involvement in this, Anouk. I know you grew up here, but now you make your way in Seattle, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. I was born and raised in Juneau, started dancing here from a very young age, have known Haley for many, many years. We used to dance together back when we were both much younger. And I've kind of made my way around different places in the lower 48, most recently Seattle, and worked with Orpheus Project probably almost 4 or 5 years ago now, but have been missing just the vibrancy in the community of creating and performing in Juneau. So kind of aptly timed, reached out to Haley a number of months ago to see if there was anything going on, and lo and behold, there was. So luckily, I was able to work it out with my life down in Seattle to come up here and to be part of this production, and it always just feels so special and like a homecoming to be able to collaborate with and get to create in the environment in which I started to dance and to be a creative person. So I always love coming back home.
Well, welcome back to Juneau. So when you look at something like this, did you get a copy of her original sort of outline so you understood what the six stages were? Mm. And then how did you approach it? Did you guys work together collaboratively on some of this choreography, or what? How did all that begin?
Yeah. I mean, Haley did the brunt work, like that whole inception of the creation of the concept and developing the phases, that was all, to me, behind closed doors, done ahead of time. And then I waltzed in here just a couple weeks ago, and Haley shared these beautiful images and drawings with me that she had done up, all just as a side note, all handwritten, which I thought was just incredibly beautiful and like tender in a world that's like so online and virtual to have these like loose pieces of paper with pencil on them. I just like absolutely loved the tactility of that.
Return to the analog, right?
So she showed me all these images, and I mean, really, it was for me, a pretty quick turnaround in terms of like diving into the world and the concept that she had developed, and kind of discussing and playing with these ideas and the stages. And then we got in the studio with the other dancers and with Haley, and it's been, you know, she's been the driving force, but it's been a lot of play, a lot of collaboration. It feels like, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it feels like there were very strong ideas, but maybe not necessarily set sequences of movement. So Haley would kind of give us the concept of like, this is the phase that we're working on, these are the emotions that we're trying to evoke. Or this is like the literal trajectory of like the drone is dying. Spoiler alert, the drone dies. and then we would play around with the ideas through improv, through dance improv, through movement, and kind of set what the how that was going to be portrayed in movement. And there's a lot of like motifs, which I really love. A lot of lifting, which is very fun. So come if you like to see some good partnering.
That's cool. So is this a particular style of dance, Haley, or is it, would we call it modern dance?
I would say it's like contemporary. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of modern, I mean, I have a lot of background in modern dance, so I always, there's movements where everyone's like, ooh, Graham. And I'm like, yeah, it does. I did just maybe lift that from Martha.
Mm-hmm.
But there's, it's really fun. I tend to also get really gestural sometimes with my own work. That's just something, you know, you start to realize what your own signatures kind of are in movement and the way that you express yourself with your body. And I do love the looseness and organic nature that comes from contemporary dance. Mm-hmm. But that's the other thing. Contemporary dance, I'd say, it's not like it is organic movement. It's kind of saying, hang your head in this way and let's like see what kind of evolves from this direction. Mm. And so what you tend to find, or at least what I'm usually looking for when I'm choreographing and having people interpret what I'm saying physically, is then I call it shopping, but I look for the thing that kind of to me looked like a very natural movement, even though it's a very intentional movement. And creating like a whole new vocabulary. Like we spent a lot of time figuring out, okay, what does a bumblebee flying around look like in our bodies if we are bumblebees? And you start to feel just different parts of your body activate. You know, who knew my shoulder blades could express deep sorrow? But they can, you know. And you find that when you work in, I feel like, the contemporary realm a little bit more maybe visibly and like readily available to you from the dancers themselves. So
that's awesome. This is Juno Afternoon on KTO. We're talking about Acoustic Turbulence, which is a performance from the Orpheus Project that's happening next weekend, Saturday, February 21st and Sunday, February 22nd. And of course, the head honcho over there at Orpheus Project is W. Todd Hunt, otherwise known as Todd, composer. And so you sort of brought in Haley to Orpheus Project as sort of your movement person, but then you were also, she was describing at the beginning before you got here, that you sort of set a challenge to her to say, hey, come up with something of that comes from you, as opposed to working on everybody else's stuff.
Right.
What do you want to do?
Yeah.
And then so she did that, and then this outline and everything, and then she comes to you with this outline, and you then as a composer, I want to talk to you, your composer brain.
Okay, I'm composer.
Not necessarily your artistic director brain, but your composer brain. Like when that happens, where does your process begin in terms of like seeing this work that she's written down, maybe some gestures, some prints or some drawings of stuff, like, and what does that do to you as a music person?
Right. So actually the document, I call it the document.
Sounds so official. Haley,
right. Because it's like 19 pages long.
Of course.
Like, you know, single spaced pictures here and there, which are also super useful. But going through in such detail, each, like, the prologue has a big old paragraph. And then the scene. So I composed the prologue, scene one, and scene five. And each of these, actually, scene five didn't have much at all. And that was a thing we worked on later.
Yeah.
But scene
endings
one
are
was
hard.
Scene one was just full of stuff. And there were so much inspiration there, but it's also like finding the bumblebee in your body. It's like finding the bumblebee in sound, and more than, you know, just buzzing, which, you know, okay, you'll hear.
It's which more instrument uses does the buzzing?
Oh, lots of them.
Lots of them. Okay.
Yeah, but it's also about finding that connection, because it's not only about bumblebees, but it's also about, well, the little subtitle, are we still using Journey of the Soul?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's like the soul of the bumblebee, but it's also sort of connected with us as well. And what is the human connection, like the thread that ties like our soul to a for example, a bumblebee soul, and the process that this life goes through. All of these different stages, the things that happen to it. It's like how do you put that into sound? And I mean, it starts off kind of hard, but you know, then like at least I found the voice of what I wanted to write relatively quickly, which is really nice, because otherwise you struggle to get started.
Do you see images or? Do words speak to you in a certain way?
Haley's words spoke to me in a certain way. Okay. There was a lot of things that I wouldn't necessarily take literally. Like I didn't secretly set the text that she wrote or anything like that. But taking it and trying to say, okay, like this, this idea of the larva like having a teardrop from Ra come down from the heavens, hit it, and then life springs from that. So it's like, oh, okay, what does that sound like? That's
me describing the beginning.
right. Because you have a lot of ancient mythology that you said you looked at, and all the theology, and so all of that was sort of in there to help inspire.
Oh yeah, these folks, wildly inspiring, and yeah, I don't know if you've talked about Ra before I got here, but I
talked about ancient Egyptian mythology.
Right. Okay. Ra plays a big, at least in my mind, the big role of the prologue and the beginning of the first scene, and one of the things I found too is like it really starts off with the previous queen bee dying and that soul ascending to Ra and the two of them communicating, you know, their ideas, which then in turn creates the sadness of Ra, which causes the teardrops to fall down. But when the soul of the bumblebee was singing to Ra, it's like, this is the simple little melody that I was then able to take through the rest of everything that I wrote. And so these nice little things happen.
So then when Todd and the other composers who were part of this, do you want to shout out their names real quick?
Oh, yeah. So Alina Levi
and
Spencer Edgars.
Okay. So when you hear them creating some of that music, then does that sort of circle back to you and kind of give you more inspiration or kind of change what you were thinking to do movement-wise?
Oh, totally. It's the dancer and the drum. It's like that. The articulation was maybe just the initial instinct or the feeling that I was, like, the impulse within me that didn't have an outlet. Mm. And then the musicians created music, and then finally my body can move.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And so that's how I felt when I was listening to it. I was, like, finally inspired to really move my body. Right. Like, I knew the instinct was there, gave them the narrative, and then
Right, because you knew the framework. Even though you knew the framework,
you didn't know exactly what
it sounds like.
Right.
I think what's interesting is the three of us composers, all are writing in pretty different styles, but I think they go together and complement each other really nicely. And it won't sound, I don't think, like too, like, wow, now we're in a huge shift to a very different
thing. But it
is nice
to have three different voices musically come through there. We're going to take a really quick break.
Okay.
This is Juno Afternoon from KTO. We'll be back in just a second here to talk a little bit more about acoustic turbulence. Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Tongass Federal Credit Union, a member-owned financial cooperative offering checking and savings accounts, loans, and digital financial services. In Juno at 8585 Old Dairy Road in the K Plaza and at tongassfcu.com, federally insured by NCUA. This is Juno Afternoon from your community public media station, KTOO. I'm Boston Christopher. I'm here in the studio talking with Anouk, Haley, and Todd about Acoustic Turbulence, which is a performance that is going to be happening through the Orpheus Project at the Thunder Mountain School Auditorium on Saturday, February 21st and Sunday, February 22nd. You can go to orpheusproject.org for more information and to get yourself a ticket. And Haley, there's going to be like, there's other things. Like last week we had on the Bees in Juno exhibit that was going to be opening up down at Spice Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all part of this too, right? Mm-hmm. And then you're going to have other, there's it's kind of like there's different elements to this whole thing. What else is going to be happening beyond the performance?
So it includes the performance, but on Saturday, the Saturday show, on Saturday the 21st, is dinner and a show. So we're partnering with Red Spruce Eatery and Forbidden Peak. And Chef Udipa will be making a special menu items, all pollinated by the bumblebee.
Really?
Yeah.
That's kind of fun.
It's kind of brought really wide open.
Is it pretty wide open?
Because okay. Bees pollinate everything.
It's pretty easy, though.
It's pretty easy.
Okay.
But yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah. They'll be doing, so Red Spruce Eatery will have a special menu, and then Forbidden Peak will be providing two beverages, and we will be providing the ticket, and that's all for $75, so it's a pretty good deal.
Okay.
You get a show, dinner, and a couple drinks. And so, yeah, that's just kind of to celebrate. I think it's fun to celebrate with people, with groups that also very much so benefit from our very humble little bumblebees.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So where are you at now? Like, Anouk, where are you at in the process? You said you arrived here a couple of weeks ago. You guys have about, 10 or another week and a half or so to go?
Yeah.
Is it like, I'm just so curious as a dancer, like, you learn these moves and then you want to get them in your body, right? So that they become sort of second nature. And when does that happen for you? Does it happen after repetition or what?
Yeah, that's the goal. It's a quick turnaround, this process. I mean, it's so interesting. I knew in a sense what had gone on before we started rehearsing, but to hear, kind of the long extended process of this creation, but our actual dance process is very condensed. I've been here 2 weeks, less than 2 weeks, I guess 2 weeks from today. And so we've had rehearsals and we'll have another, 10-ish days of rehearsal, less than that. So it's been a lot of generation. You know, we have a whole show to set movement to. So the majority of the time in the studio has been generating movement and creating the spaces, creating the shapes, the motifs, and then repeating it as much as we can so we can get it down. But it's really just kind of up to us within the studio, the dancers and Haley, to try to remember what we did yesterday so we can repeat it and then do it again. So we take a lot of videos.
Lots of videos.
It's been super fun. We're still definitely in the generation phase, but there's something to say about like kind of having a timeline and having to make decisions quickly. And sometimes I find that makes things more interesting because you don't get to overthink it, which I like to do. And I think a lot of artists, we like to overthink if we're given the time.
Yeah, for sure. Haley, did you spend a lot of time like in the studio by yourself, like coming up with some of the moves, or were you, how did that process go before the dancers came?
A lot of it I see in my mind's eye. Like, I know what kind of what I want something to kind of look like or what I think. And I think that might just be from experience. You know,
right,
I work on
right.
a lot of tight turnarounds with choreography. So I trust my subconscious. I trust my brain to just noodle on something. And then I'm able to kind of walk into a room and just be really present. And that is actually the most important tool I have is just my presence in the space. And so I like to play a lot in the initial phase. So just throwing what my body instinctually, like impulsively wants to do at them and watching that. And then I'll reshape or evolve that into what I want it to ultimately look like.
So I see. Okay. And one last thing before we run out of time, I want to make sure that we shout out some of these other collaborators that you have, because we mentioned movement, we mentioned music, but there's also poetry.
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about that poetry piece.
So our poet, Dita Devi, she took the same narrative that the composers did, and then anything that spoke to her, that was kind of my direction to her, was anything that actually speaks to you, write about, and we'll incorporate your poems into the and then that was the biggest challenge for the composers was then that they took her words and layered them into their music, which was really cool. We didn't know really how it would kind of all come together.
Well, it all happened really fast too, because the pieces have to be, the music has to be done, and we have to come up with some sort of mock-up before Haley can even really start working on her choreo. So all of the poetry and the music really had to happen quickly and early.
Yeah.
Well, it's just a fascinating process, like to take the all of those collaborative efforts on a new piece, original piece, something that has never been done before, and to then bring it all together. And so I'm curious, there's going to be two shows, but is there going to be life beyond those two shows, considering the show is about the journey of life? Like, what are we going to do after the show? It doesn't just die, I hope.
I hope it doesn't. I think getting to this milestone is, kind of what's at the top of mind right now, at least for me. But I know when I was doing my research for the project, I thought of a million other ways I wanted to where I wanted to take this. One of them was, I've listened to so many podcasts and watched so many YouTubes about bumblebees and trying to advocate for bumblebees. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this is maybe a way to help people access that animal a little bit in a much different way, instead of just regurgitating the life cycle of the bumblebee and the importance. It's about so much more than that. That's like one example, but I had I have a lot of other places that I would love to take the work that we've created. But iteration one first.
Right.
Milestone
one
first.
I know. That's what we got to get through this coming weekend.
Iteration one happening. Anouk, Haley, and Todd from the Orpheus Project. It's called Acoustic Turbulence. It's a brand new piece with so many collaborators here in Juneau.
We didn't mention Greg Mitchell, doing projections.
You're going to have projections.
We're going to have projections and, of course, lighting design as well from Mike Inwood.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. So all these folks who've come into town, and then all the people who are in town, Spencer Edgar's composer, local, Alina Levi, local composer, of course, Todd Hunt, local composer, Haley Duran, local choreographer, Dita Devi, local, and then, of course, sharing with people who've been here before, like Anouk, who've come back to be Queen Bumblebee. That's so cool. And all of the dancers. So go to orpheusproject.org to find out more information, see the whole list of activities that are surrounding this. Go see the Bees in Juno exhibit, all those wonderful things. And it's going to be a really exciting piece.
Yes.
Gwyneth Cheesh for being here and telling us about it.
Yeah. Thanks, Boston.
Thank you,
really
Boston.
Appreciate it. Yes. This is Juno Afternoon on KTOO.
Support from Hanson Gress. Seeking curious people who like technology, network engineering, and customer support. Opportunities for those who thrive on problem solving. Details at hansongress.com/careers.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Many high school students spend time after school writing papers, singing in a choir, or playing baseball. But Nathan Tan, a junior at St. Mark's School of Texas in Dallas, devotes much of his time to environmental causes, like advocating for clean air and restoring wildlife habitat.
We, as young people, really need to take a stand, and I think it's very important that we take that action and continue inspiring people that are many generations older than us.
Last year, Tan founded the Shared Skies Initiative, a nonprofit that's monitoring air pollution in parts of Dallas. Many neighborhoods near factories or highways are heavily polluted, so the nonprofit is installing air quality sensors to collect data that can be used to advocate for change. Tan also works with his school's prairie restoration crew, which plants native wildflowers and grasses to help rebuild patches of the original prairie ecosystem, much of which has been lost to sprawl and farming. He encourages young people who are worried about the environment to spend some time reading news about people implementing solutions.
Understanding that there is progress being made across the entire world can be really inspiring.
And he urges young people to pick an issue they care about and start taking small steps. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You You are listening to community-supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Auk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. You can also join us on our live stream on KTOO's YouTube and Facebook pages. I'm Boston Christopher. Underwater archaeologist Kelly Monteleone joins me now in studio. Kelly is next up in the Fireside Lecture Series from the Forest Service. Her talk, Our Ancient Past, Submerged Archaeology in Southeast Alaska, is this Friday, February 13th at 7 p.m. at the Mendenhall Visitor Center. And she will be detailing her work with the side-scan sonar to explore the Southeast Alaska seabed. Gunathish Haiyugudi, thank you so much, Kelly. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Gunathish, thank you for having me.
Okay, so I have so many questions. Underwater archaeology, how does one get involved in that?
There's not that many of us. I think we're now up to about 30 of us in North America.
Wow.
There's a whole another 30 over in Europe, and you know, that maybe makes 100 around the world. So it's not a big group of us.
That's amazing.
And most of them focus on shipwrecks.
Okay, but you don't.
I don't do shipwrecks. I want to find a, you know, indigenous wreck at some point. Like, I'd love to find a canoe
that's
more than 10,000 years old. But that's the only wreck I really am that interested in.
Okay.
So around this time last year, the fireside chat was actually a friend of mine, Jenya, talking about the Star of Bengal.
Okay, I remember that.
Yep. Yeah, so there's a lot of shipwreck archaeology out there.
Mm-hmm.
But my focus is on submerged landscapes. So these are places that people have lived in the past that the sea level has now risen over.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, so these are like normal archaeology, just like we do on land. But right now, that area is underwater. But that means that the locations can have really high preservation. Things have never been disturbed by people. They still get disturbed by the environment.
Yeah.
But our chances at treasure hunters and things like that are a lot lower.
How did the water overlay what was under there before?
Oh, it's really fun. It's a multifaceted thing. But we're talking about the glacial maximum when sea levels were globally 120 meters lower.
Okay.
So that was because the ice was trapped in glaciers on the continents in the Northern Hemisphere.
Mm.
But then the weight of the glacier being right there, like, well, literally here in Juneau, was pressing the land down. And that caused a bulge of land out on the outside where the glaciers were. So past the glaciers, what we call refugia, which is kind of getting questioned right now. We got areas still, I think.
Okay.
But the idea being that that land would have been pushed up even further so that now that land that was exposed out on the continental shelf 16, 17,000 years ago is now 160 to 170 meters below modern levels.
Oh, wow.
And that's where the, you know, end of the LGM sea level is.
Okay.
It's way out there off Prince of Wales Island, off Sitka. But that's not the same sea level for somewhere like Juneau or Ketchikan.
Okay.
So this is just, you know, the west side of Prince of Wales and similar sea level curve for Sitka area, not the rest of the inside of the islands.
Okay.
There, the sea levels would have been higher, like the land would have been above the water even more because of that bulge.
Right.
And how that all works out. There's also gravity at play in there, but we need a geophysicist to talk about all of that.
So I'm so fascinated by how, I mean, there's so few of you underwater archaeologists. And like you said, most of them are focused on boat wrecks, I guess. But you're looking at like civilization and how people lived and so what have you discovered in some – and does this mean most of your work you spend underwater?
Oh, I wish.
No, but anyway, what have you discovered? Yeah, let's
– So most of my work is spent looking at sonar and then sending remote-operated vehicles down.
Okay.
And so back in 2010, I got to send a side-scan sonar. We towed that behind a vessel, and we kind of get something like an aerial photograph where you can see shadows of things and stuff like that.
Mm.
And I thought I found a fish trap.
Oh, wow.
On the seafloor at 52 meters. And we went back in 2012 and we took an ROV down and we had this like fishbowl lens view. And I've since found out we went right over it in 2012. Yeah. So it was 20 meters off where we thought it was.
Mm.
And I can hear us saying, well, we can't find it as we're floating over it. And then we cut to record to DVD because this is that long ago that we still weren't recording on digital devices yet.
Mm.
So we had to stop recording and I can't actually see the fish trap at that time. We didn't think we were there. Went back with new funding in 2022 and used it as a drift dive with the ROV and let the ROV drift over to it and found it on 3 or 4 dives easily every
what
time.
What is an ROV?
Remote operated vehicle.
Okay, so nobody's in it.
No. These are only like the side.
They're little
like,
tiny like, things.
A little bigger than a basketball.
Okay, and the side scan sonar is another device that can get sent down there. And sonar is just sound, right? So you're getting the sound waves bouncing off and trying to look for like shadows and image. Is that how you're
yes,
finding
exactly.
stuff?
Yes, exactly. Okay. So shadows showing you like raised things have a shadow behind them because it's sending out a signal and receiving the response back.
Ah.
And so it can see things. It also sees density changes. Okay. So when people live somewhere, they actually like increase the density of that location for sediments.
Mm.
And so we see sediment density changes too. So I'm also looking for shell middens and things like that under there. And I think I might have some of those, but I haven't gotten back out to check any of those yet.
So when you discover this stuff, then what do you do with that data and that information? What is your end goal to find out?
Well, the main thing is just telling people about it.
Okay, yeah.
We're working on publications still,
okay.
Because as I said, we only just reconfirmed it in 2022, and it was
right.
part of a larger project. But the main thing was, is I did like a lecture tour after that.
I see.
And so I lectured around a lot of different places. But one of the things was I was working with Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, even though I wasn't working at Sea Alaska Heritage Institute at the time. And the Council of Traditional Scholars helped develop a name for the location. So this site was recorded in the Alaska State Office of History and Archaeology database. And it's a preserved location.
Mm.
So it's protected. To some extent.
Mm-hmm.
We
from us, not from the environment.
Right? The environment. No,
right.
I'm
yeah,
sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you do go to the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute YouTube page and search for Fish Weir, you will find a short little video we put together of me driving an ROV on there.
Oh, cool.
And I'll show a bit of that on Friday, too.
Okay. Yeah, that's really cool. I mean, obviously, the idea that it exists and also knowing that people were living there and it kind of maybe says something about the past a little bit, right?
Well, yeah, and this is the oldest confirmed fish trap or weir in the world.
Wow.
Down in Haida Gwaii, one of my colleagues did similar things and in 2014 found one on sonar also, but nobody's gone down and confirmed it with an ROV or divers yet.
Okay.
So that one would be a little over 14 or about 14,000 years ago.
Holy moly.
Yeah, there's people been on this coast for a long time.
That's amazing. Okay, so this talk on Friday, Our Ancient Past, Submerged Archaeology in Southeast Alaska. It's going to be Friday, February 13th, 7 p.m. It's part of the Fireside Lecture Series from the Forest Service. It's going to be out at the Mendenhall Visitor Center. What are we going to be talking about? I know some of the stuff we just talked about, but what are the things you're going to be bringing up on Friday?
So the new thing that I'm finally getting present for the first time on Friday is the results of this submerged cave project. We took a couple sediment cores from the Ladrone Islands. We were looking for caves and rock overhangs, places people would have lived when the sea levels were lower.
Mm.
And I have a sediment core that we dated back about 12,000 years ago.
Wow.
So we're like, we're getting there where we could have had terrestrial. And I had a lady doing pollen analysis from UAF, Nancy Bigelow, and Vera Pospaloff from the University of Minnesota, who analyzed dinoflagellate cysts.
Mm.
And we put it all together, and we've actually like reconstructed what the environment would have been like in that location going back 12,000 years now.
That's amazing. That is amazing. So you're going to be presenting some of that on Friday.
Yes, yes. So
oh.
this is the new piece to the puzzle to help us hone in on where to look to identify more archaeology, more evidence of humans' past, because the goal is to try to see if we can get before the last glacial maximum as they keep finding potential sites that are going back almost 25,000 years.
Whoa.
So, yeah, there's sites in the lower 48 and then on the north slope of Alaska that are pushing, you know, 25 to 30,000 years now, and all of them are still being debated within the archaeological circle. This is science. People publish things. They have arguments. They go back and forth, and
right.
decisions eventually get made about some of these sites. But that means that we have potential here to go even further back. And so we need to understand the environment and where sites could be protected.
Oh, that's amazing. And so where can people, beyond Friday, I know that the Fireside Talks, do you know if they're archived? Do they film them?
They were being live streamed on Facebook and left there, but I don't know where that's at in the new
setup. In the new way. Okay. So if you may or may not get to see it if you can't make it on Friday. But if you can't make it on Friday, where could people follow some of this information? Because this is really fascinating. Like,
Sea Alaska Heritage Institute's media department is really good at publicizing what I'm doing.
Okay.
But I gave, with my collaborator on the CAVE project, Christoph Richmond, we co-presented for SHI in the fall of 2024.
Mm-hmm.
Four? Yes. I think it was that fall. Yeah. And that's recorded on SHI's YouTube page.
Okay, yeah. SHI's YouTube page is a lot of info, right?
Yes,
yeah.
And we also produced a short video for that project, which is also on that website.
I think that's the one I watched.
That's the one I shared
with
you,
yeah, okay, you've shared that with me. It's really easy. It's like 6 minutes. I'll link to it on the webpage for this episode on the podcast so people can find that and look at it. It's really cool. And is that machine that's in there, that's the remote-operated vehicle?
No, that's Sunfish. It's an autonomous underwater vehicle that was exploring caves for us.
Autonomous underwater vehicle?
Yeah, they can tell it to go do things, and it goes off on its own and will come home even.
I love that. That's amazing. Well, you can head out to the Mendenhall Visitor Center this Friday, 7 p.m., Friday, February 13th, Our Ancient Past Submerged Archaeology in Southeast Alaska. Go to Sea Alaska Heritage's YouTube page. You might be able to find some, and just search Kelly Monteleone, right? And then you'll find it. And as she said, the media department is great about letting people know about this because it's really fascinating stuff.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. It was fascinating for me to learn a little bit about this, Kelly. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Gunnath Sheesh. This is Juno Afternoon on KTOO.
This is Bird Note. For some birds, having the best nest is a key part of attracting a mate. Males of many weaver bird species construct a series of intricately woven nests with which to lure a prospective partner. If a female is dissatisfied with it, though, she doesn't just move on. She tears the nest apart, as if to show her disdain. A male red-winged blackbird can even attract multiple mates if he controls a prime breeding territory, where nests can be built over the water, making them less accessible to predators like raccoons. Adélie penguins construct their nests on mounds of stones, which help guard against flooding, and partners often exchange stone gifts during the course of construction. Unfortunately, stones can be in short supply, which leads to skirmishes within the nesting colony, as stones are stolen and fiercely guarded. No stone, one might say, left unturned. For Bird Note, I'm Wenfei Tong.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon from Studio 2K at KTOO, dedicated to Carolyn Hobbs Peterson. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Juno Audubon Society presents Fins, Fur, and Feathers. I like alliteration. Fins, Furs, and Feathers of the Amazon and the Galapagos by Kari Monagle and Kim Kiefer. That's Thursday, February 12th, that's tomorrow at 6:30 p.m. out at the UAS Egan Lecture Hall, room 112. Of course, it's free and open to the public. I am joined now in studio by Kari Monagle. Gunnath Sheesh, Wasiti. Kari, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Excellent. And Kim Kiefer, nice to see you again.
Nice
Wasiti.
To see you, Boston.
Excellent. And Brenda Wright, of course, from the Juno Audubon Society, here to back us up and make sure we have all the details correct. How are you,
Brenda? I migrate this way a lot.
You do indeed. Well, Gunnath Sheesh, Hat Yeh Adi, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you all here. So Where do we begin? Fins, fur, and feathers of the Amazon and the Amazon and Galapagos. Where did this idea come from? Who's you guys are friends and partners in crime here? Who
sisters.
Started
sisters.
Sisters. Sisters? Who started this madness?
Kim did.
There's a pointing a finger yes. over at Kim. So yes. tell us where this idea germinate, Kim.
Well, actually, it germinated from the fact that I was having my 65th birthday and Kari was going into her 60th year. And it's like, we need to go do something together to celebrate. And we decided, we looked at a variety of things and places we want to go. And we landed on the Galapagos and then going over into the jungle.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So when did this trip happen?
2 years ago.
January of 24.
Okay. That's amazing. And what did you discover? Had you ever been there? Either of you been there before?
No.
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 So, and was it, why did that place call to you? What was it about it?
The birds. The birds. Well, you had talked about the Galapagos, and I actually taught biology for decades at JDHS.
Okay.
So, but that was never really on my radar. It's like, okay, yeah, I know there's giant tortoises and there's Darwin's finches and stuff, but I never really thought about it. And so Kim was like, let's go to the Galapagos. And then we were thinking about going to Easter Island as kind of a tag on. But that would be iconic. It would be neat. But I wanted more wildlife. And so we're right there. Let's go to the Amazon. So
oh, wow. Okay.
That's kind of what put it all together.
It was a quick trip. It was 11 days.
Well, with travel time, I think we spent 5 days in the Galapagos, 4 days in the Amazon, and then 2 days each way traveled. So
okay, so just from my own personal knowledge, were the turtles as big as?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Just, are they just like
oh,
to
huge.
See them in? I mean, pictures and video is one thing, but to see them in person,
yeah.
Oh, what's
yeah.
that like?
Oh,
yeah.
They're huge. So just to give you an idea how big they are, Kari was able to climb into the shell and the tortoise,
the giant tortoises.
She climbed into. They've got one in the visitor area. She was able to climb into it, and still there was room around her.
Wow!
Yeah. Yeah. They come big. About 3 feet high.
Yeah.
The back of their carapace.
Wow, that's
so
giant.
So they hang out where the cattle are. So when the farmers there, they have to build their fences to keep the cattle in, but they're required to have the fence level up 3 or 4 feet. So that the tortoises can go underneath and have free movement everywhere and don't get caught
wow.
in the fences, but the cattle will stay in.
Okay, so now I know you saw the turtles and the Galapagos, but do you see other things there too, right? What else
yeah.
do you see there?
All sorts of stuff. It was amazing, you know, for somebody that was kind of like, oh yeah, this will be all right. It was an incredible trip.
Yeah.
So in the Galapagos, one of the cool things, I think the first day we're looking down from our small boat, only 16 passengers, and hammerhead shark.
Oh.
And then there's Galapagos sea lions, Galapagos penguins. There were turtles there. There were black-tip sharks, white-tip sharks, Galapagos sharks, blue-footed boobies, Nazca boobies. There were frigate birds. They're all sorts of lava lizards. Just incredible all the
That's
time
amazing.
You're on these adventures and seeing things. I think in the Galapagos I had 24 new to me species of birds, just birds. And then in the Amazon I think it was 66
new
lifers for me.
Wow. And so you're logging all these in eBird and stuff like that? Or
I would record them on Merlin and get my life list, but I wasn't hitting it in that. But we kept a list. I was frantically writing down stuff.
Wow.
As we're
those
doing.
Apps, eBird and Merlin, those apps Brenda's talked about many times in terms of the Great Backyard Bird Count.
Yeah, this weekend.
Oh, that's this weekend?
This weekend starts Friday.
Oh. Well, how did I know? How did I in my brain have that in there in the back of my mind? I was like, that's got to be coming up soon. So we'll get to that in just a second, Brenda. So I'm imagining that your talk tomorrow, this is going to be tomorrow night. It's at the UAS Egan Lecture Hall, room 112. I'm talking with Kari Monagle and Kim Kiefer. They're doing a talk called Fins, Furs, and Feathers of the Amazon and the Galapagos, presented by the Juno Audubon Society. You're going to have, are we going to see tons of pictures and stuff?
Oh, pictures,
yeah.
Some video.
Video, okay.
There's, between the two of us, we probably had I mean, I know we had thousands of pictures. Yeah. So we could go a lot longer, but...
It'll be an hour, right?
Or yeah. It'll probably be about 45 minutes or so of photos and then questions.
And then some questions and stuff like
question
that. Okay. Answer. That is really cool. That's going to be a lot of fun. Now, Brenda, this is part of the sort of winter lecture series that you all do.
That's correct.
How many more do we have?
There's one in March, and it's at the Planetarium.
Okay, there'll be one in March at the Planetarium. And, of course, just for those who want to follow along, you go to JunoAudubon.org, hit the events tab. It tells you all the things that are coming up. So, Brenda, let's make sure we mention this. The Great Backyard Bird Count is this weekend. Tell me how we get involved.
It's very, very simple. If you use eBird or Merlin at all you have to do is look out your window, step out your door, take a walk, take three walks. and it's all 4 days, as many as you want to do.
Oh, so how many? Does it start Friday?
Friday and goes to Monday.
Okay, so Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. And you can take as many walks, and we're just trying to get us. What is this for? What is the Great Backyard Bird Count
for? It's just like the Migration Bird Day in fall. We're trying to see what birds live here and what strange and different things might be here. But we just want to know who's living here and where.
I see. Okay. And is this a time, Brenda, where... We're starting to see, have things started to return yet, or are they still not quite?
Not the really
not
smart
warm enough
ones,
yet,
you
right?
know.
They know we had that snowpocalypse not too long ago. Yeah.
And none of the insect-eating birds come this far north this soon.
Okay. And that becomes more like, because in April is when y'all start your
bird
walks.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Right? Okay.
Yep.
And those go on throughout part of the summer.
Yes.
Yeah. So those will be happening. We'll have you back to talk about those, of course, as well. That's fantastic. So if it's really easy to, and these Merlin and eBird apps are like on my phone.
Yep.
Yes.
And they're free.
And they're free.
Yes.
And Kara, you've used it. How easy is the Merlin app?
Oh, it's great. What I've used it for a long time. When I first started using it, you'd have to go in and kind of go, okay, how big was your bird? What primary colors are you looking at? Where was it at? All that kind of stuff. Now you can, what's really handy is if I'm in the field and I have a picture of a bird that I don't know, and if I should spend time really trying to get closer, I can take a picture with my phone and it'll identify or give me a list of possibilities. Through a picture. It also, I'm not very good on sounds and the calls and stuff. And so you can also turn it on and go, what the heck is that bird? And listen to it that way, and it'll give you a list of ones. And then it'll keep a life list, and it'll ask you if you want to submit it to Merlin or to eBird. And
wow. Sometimes technology is good.
Yeah. Oh, it
right?
is good.
Sometimes technology is useful for positive things.
Especially the sound one. I use the sound one a lot because then it will tell you what kind of what birds it's hearing, and then you know where to look.
Oh,
so
yeah,
it's like, okay, oh, I know this bird, and it tends to hang up on the tops of the trees, or it's down on the ground looking around. So it lets you know where to look to be able to try and see what it's hearing.
Mm. And sometimes as a person that doesn't have the best hearing, I'll be looking at it, and I'll hear one bird, a crow or something, and there's 15 other ones that I haven't heard yet.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, okay, I might want to go see that.
And one more time, Kim, tell us just what your talk's about tomorrow.
It is about our trip to the Galapagos and the Amazon rainforest. And so that's why you've got fins, furs, and feathers, because we saw all of it.
As well as butterflies that didn't fit into
quite you didn't fit into the alliteration. Flies doesn't sound as good as butterflies.
Yeah.
Juno Audubon presents Fins, Furs, and Feathers of the Amazon and Galapagos by Kari Monagle and Kim Kiefer tomorrow night, Thursday, February 12th, 6:30 p.m. out at the UAS Egan at Lecture Hall, room 112. Of course, it's free and it's open to the public, as all Juno Audubon Society events are. Gwyneth Cheesh for being here and telling us about it. Thank you, Brenda, for bringing these two in, partnering them up, and making this happen.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you,
really
Boston.
Really appreciate it. Gwyneth Cheesh. And that's going to wrap it up for today's Juno Afternoon. On tomorrow's show, wearable art preview, plus Plinkett and Haida Summer Ambassador Program, and the Five Hearts on Franklin Valentine's Day celebration. Juno Afternoon airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTO Juno 104.3 and KAUK Juno Auk Bay 91.7. Hello, out the road. You can find the show online at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon. You can also find live stream archives on KTOO's YouTube page. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. Programming support for Juno Afternoon comes from listeners and viewers like you and Hanson Grass, Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, and Tongass Federal Credit Union. Juno Afternoon is a project of the KTOO Arts and Culture team. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Aaron Tripp. Gunath Cheesh!